Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chew Manchu, and I'm with our awesome showrunner, Dr. Sam Mazur. What's up, man?
Great to be here. Excellent episode. Let's get going.
Not with us today is Dr. Emily Wells, who was under the weather and could not join us today, but she can say hi from home. Say hi, Emily. I think she's probably saying hi. Our guest tonight is Dr. Matthew Blessing, here to discuss cleft lips and cleft palates. But first, Sam, do you want to remind us about the show?
Absolutely, Chris. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine. I'm also just going to take the next part right off the bat here. So we have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Matt Blessing. Dr. Blessing is a former primary care pediatrician who now works in the Craniofacial Center at Seattle Children's Hospital. He loves working with medically complex patients and their families in the Craniofacial and 22Q11 clinics. And he says he's still finding his way on his relatively new inpatient responsibilities. However, he loves collaborating with residents, medical students, and APP fellows as well. So Dr. Blessing teaches us today about feeding difficulties, surgical timing, and complications you wouldn't necessarily expect.
Our listeners are going to love the wide palette of information they're going to get today.
Oh, well done, Chris. Well done.
Yeah. There. I got it.
Crushed it.
Hello, Dr. Matthew Blessing. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Because we're an informal group, is it okay to call you by your first name?
Definitely.
Excellent. All right. We're going to start off with some questions just to get to know you for our listeners. Could you describe yourself, who you are, where you're at, and maybe a little something outside of medicine that you enjoy?
Sure. I am a craniofacial pediatrician. I live in Seattle, Washington. I was a primary care provider for 11 years before switching to this team. And I guess something outside of medicine is I am trying to learn how to do woodworking, but I'm not very good at it yet.
Nice. Like power tools or like hand tools or what type of woodworking are you into?
Yeah, I'm trying to transition from power tools to hand tools, mostly because my garage is extremely small and I can't walk through it. So I'm trying to kind of do, I don't want to be a hand tool purist, but like just downsize the number of power tools so I can move out there. Yeah.
You're practical, gotcha. Practical hand tool guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice.
Awesome.
I was going to ask one more question. So you said you're a general pediatrician for 11 years, and then you sort of ended up in sort of this craniofacial niche. How did that happen? That's sort of an interesting way. Most people after a decade don't want to really make any big changes in their lives.
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed primary care, but I was not very good at the managing the clock. So at the end of almost every day, I would be a ball of stress because I couldn't keep up. I like to spend a lot of time with each family. And I often had to decide like in between like urinating or seeing another patient, around 2 to 4 PM every day. Like it would be like, I could feel the urine going backwards up to my kidneys, but I had to just keep seeing another patient. And so I got an email one day from Michael Cunningham, who is the head of our division at Craniofacial, and he asked if I might be interested in a new job. And I was just burned out enough from the time. I loved my job, but at the same time, I was burning out a little bit. And so that was what got me curious, because we chatted a little bit and I heard a little bit about the extra time because I was on their radar because I managed a lot of complex patients from the hospital on the outpatient setting. So I felt like I had a comfort zone with that realm. So, yeah.
Very cool. Very cool.
That's one of the most relatable stories, I think, that all of our listeners are going to hear, right? That like trying to decide whether I should pee, do I have time to pee, or are going to see more patients and honestly, because I want to spend more than 15 minutes with someone. It's the most reasonable thing I've heard all day, and I've been at the hospital all day too. So, Let me ask you another question, if that's all right. What is your favorite failure, and what do you think you learned from it?
Well, I think I just touched on it. So I think my favorite failure is that I feel like I couldn't quite hack it in primary care, but I feel like the reason why I couldn't hack it anymore was that I just really enjoy spending a long time with every family. And I guess kind of on a side note, kind of like just acknowledging the burnout and acknowledging stress. Like I think I try to be very open and not complainy, but real, especially with trainees regarding stress at work and stress in residency, and that medicine is hard, and that that can be, it's okay to acknowledge that.
You know? Yeah. No, yeah. Thank you. And this is a good opportunity for all of us to acknowledge it here. And Matt, you're getting your word out, not just to the trainees from your program, but also whoever's listening to hear as well. You guys can hear that story and recognize it happening for all of us. Do you feel like you can never get ahead of charting? Imagine a world where you don't need to think about notes again. Introducing Freed, an AI medical scribe built to free clinicians everywhere. It listens, transcribes, and writes instant clinical notes for you in your style. Freed can be used across all specialties for in-office as well as virtual visits, and it works in multiple languages. Written in your style and ready the moment the visit is over, all you have to do is copy it into your EHR. Freed is HIPAA compliant and only takes seconds to learn. Over 15,000 clinicians, including doctors, APPs, therapists, use Freed to save up to 2 hours every day and free themselves from documentation. Just imagine the great feeling of coming home without any notes hanging over your head. Get back to doing what you love and let Freed do the rest. So, Cribsiders listeners, start your free trial today. No credit card needed. Use code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe. That's code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month. On that note, Chris, should we get into
it? Yeah, we should get into it, man.
Awesome. All right. So I'll read this case. Don't mind us with the name.
We didn't write it.
It didn't write it. Right. Here we go. All right. So Oro Face is a 5-day-old female born at 39 and 2 with a postnatal diagnosis of unilateral cleft lip and palate, here for her first well child check. So she is down 10% from her birth weight, and her mom is concerned for poor feeding. She's trying to directly breastfeed, but she's also supplementing with formula. Her first multidisciplinary visit with the Cashlat craniofacial team is scheduled for day of life 7. So here you are as the primary care doctor seeing her right before that. But before we even get into what happens on those first visits, let's talk a little bit about cleft lips and palate. So can you kind of talk us through the different subtypes of cleft lip and or cleft palate and what the differences are?
Sure. Yeah. You know, there's a couple of different ways you could go about it. So like first, I would think of like the different types of cleft lip, acknowledging that yes, like you could have cleft lip with cleft palate or cleft lip alone. So within cleft lip, you could have a complete cleft, which is probably the most common, where it is a cleft that goes all the way through the lip and connects with the nostril. Whereas an incomplete cleft of the lip, you would still have an intact nostril on the cleft side. And then there's a rare form that is called the form Frust cleft lip, where you can barely see it at all. And almost it sometimes is misdiagnosed as a surgical repair, but the child was born with it. And we do sometimes see those in clinic and do think like, okay, could they be at any risk for any cleft related issues, because it's a spectrum, you know? And so we occasionally see those too. So if you ever see a patient in primary care and is like, how do you have a surgical scar at a week old? Then that's a very rare thing, but I digress. Then within cleft palate, there could be an isolated cleft of the soft palate or an isolated cleft of the soft and hard palate, where there is no cleft lip, or you could have cleft lip and cleft palate. And the most common scenario when there is cleft lip and cleft palate is for the cleft to be continuous all the way from the lip through the gum line, which we often call the alveolus, and then through the entire palate. But there can be other variations where you could have a cleft lip, cleft of the gum line, and then no cleft of the hard palate and a cleft of the soft palate. So it can be very discontinuous. Those are less common, but things to watch out for. And then there can be kids who have isolated cleft lip who don't have a cleft of the gum line. So there can be kids with, it's more common for the gum line to be involved if there's cleft lip. It's less common for the gum line to be involved if you have an isolated cleft palate. Another less common and tricky category is something called a submucous cleft palate, which it can present as the mucous membrane on the inside of the mouth is intact, but there is clefting of the muscles of the soft palate, or perhaps even the bone of the hard palate underneath an intact mucous membrane. And within that spectrum can be bifid uvula. 90% of the time that somebody has a bifid uvula, they don't also have a submucous cleft. Usually they just have a bifid uvula, which is benign, but is probably on the spectrum of the very beginning of a cleft palate. But sometimes if there is a submucous cleft, then sometimes when a baby cries or a toddler vocalizes, there can be tenting where the soft palate rises, instead of rising kind of like a dome, which would be what we would typically expect. It's more tenting like an upside down V. And there also can be a zona pellucidum, which is like a shiny, translucent, white vertical line in the midline. Submucous clefts can be tricky because they can be completely asymptomatic, in which case they should be left alone surgically, or they could be very symptomatic and lead to similar feeding and speech issues to an overt cleft palate.
And so let me just kind of summarize a little bit about that. We'll make sure I get it right. And then I just want to ask kind of a little bit of incidence questions there. So it sounds like you can have isolated cleft lip, isolated cleft palate, or a combination between the two. When you have an isolated cleft lip, at least it seems like the most common scenario is going all the way up to the nose. And as far as the cleft palate and lip together, you would usually see it going as one continuous all the way from the nose to the lip, to the soft palate, and then to the into the hard palate there. Which one is more common? Cleft lip on its own, cleft lip and palate together, or cleft palate on its own?
Cleft lip and palate together is more common than cleft palate alone, and also more common than cleft lip alone. Okay. And one thing I would clarify is I'm not positive. If you have isolated cleft lip, I'm not certain that a complete cleft of the lip is the most common. That I'd have to look. I'm not certain.
Gotcha. But when we think about this, it sounds like we should be thinking that it's going to be both involved for a complete cleft.
Yeah. And there's so many different ways to categorize it. Another thing to keep in mind is bilateral versus unilateral cleft lip. So if you have a bilateral cleft lip, then the area, the philtrum, and then the area where your incisors will come in on of your maxillary gum line there's a cleft typically on both sides of it. And so then that structure, which is called the premaxilla, is kind of free to travel in space a little bit more than with a unilateral cleft. And so that's something that we can talk about in terms of like preparation for surgery. And it also really feeds into to feeding issues in infancy.
So I appreciate you talking and walking us through all the different types of and subtypes of cleft lip and palate and combinations. It seems like many of them may be fairly obvious, especially just looking at the baby. How often would you say it's sort of missed in the newborn period right after birth? And if so, how are the ways in which we can try not, what are some ways we could maybe not miss it, I should say?
Yeah. I think by far the most common scenario for it to be missed is when it's isolated cleft palate, because submucous cleft, I guess you could argue, is even more likely to be missed. But I'd like to lower the temperature on missing that, because those kids might do quite well, but I think if you have a baby who appears to have an intact palate, but and you're like, boy, I'm really getting a good look at it, but it does look, something looks a little different about it, and this baby, every time they spit up, it's coming out through their nose instead of through their mouth, and they're just having a lot of feeding problems, I think just trust your instinct that you've seen a lot of babies' palates and this one just looks a little different, then a lot of times in primary care you just have to trust your gut on that and refer. I think the more common scenario is that it is an overt cleft of the palate, but it is hard sometimes to get a great view of the palate in the newborn phase. And it is not easy for prenatal ultrasounds to pick up on an isolated cleft palate at all. So a cleft lip and palate, it's very much the norm now that we already know about it before the baby's even born, and hopefully have had a chance to have a prenatal visit with the family to prepare them.
And so actually just jumping on Chris's question, that actually brings up a good point. So say we are... It's hard to say, you know, isolated cleft palate, we'll just say that's what it is because that's the hardest to see. And what symptoms should we see that come with that to say, hey, we missed it on our visual exam, but now we're starting to see X, Y, and Z symptoms. So what should we be paying attention for to put that back on our differential?
Yeah, definitely. I think difficulty with feeding would be universal in that scenario because the baby would not be able to generate any suction because when they try to generate suction, the air is just going to escape out through their nose. And so unfortunately, babies with cleft palate cannot effectively breastfeed, but they also can't very effectively get milk out of a standard bottle either. And so they typically will be pretty low in weight, probably pretty jaundiced if we're thinking of that early phase. Yeah. And they also will typically have reflux come out through their nose much more often than, you know, that's not like, you know, that's not super alarming if a baby occasionally has a little bit of spit up out their nose. But if that's like more the norm for them, then that's a bit of an orange flag for me that they could have a cleft palate. And then I think it's sort of a trick that I developed preceding my craniofacial time. I just hated using tongue depressors in primary care on infants and toddlers for time reasons and baby torture reasons. I just hated it. And so I found that if I put on a glove and I would put just a little bit of gentle pressure on the front or the anterior portion of the upper and lower gum lines, a lot of babies will open really wide because they're like, no, you're missing my mouth. Like, that's not where the bottle goes in. And they'll open really, really wide. And I usually could see about 80 to 90% of the baby's palate, maybe not the uvula. Sometimes if you really want to see the uvula, you do have to get tougher, but I'm kind of wimpy. But some more larger overt clefts, you can easily see them with that trick without having to break out the tongue depressor.
Awesome. I love that. That's a helpful tip that we can use. I was going to ask another symptom type question, if that's all right. We are moving towards a patient that we now says, hey, we have a cleft lip, we have a cleft palate. We know this is a congenital anomaly. Are there anything else that we should be evaluating on that initial exam when we're concerned for other congenital anomalies that might be associated with cleft lip or palate?
Yeah, so we try in the craniofacial center to do a head-to-toe exam. There, about 30% of the time, there is an identifiable syndrome in patients who have cleft lip and palate, and it goes up to more like 50-ish percent if they have isolated cleft palate. So isolated cleft palate actually increases the risk. In the scenario of cleft lip and palate, a lot of the familial cases of cleft lip and palate are due to Vanderwood syndrome, which is cleft lip and palate with little pits on the lip that are sometimes really hard to notice and sometimes become more evident over time. And there's not a lot else linked with Vanderwood beyond the clefting. So really with cleft lip and palate, but especially with cleft palate, there's an increased risk of 22q 11.2 deletion syndrome, which has about 100 names. So it also is still commonly called DeGeorge syndrome and velocardiofacial syndrome, but we're trying to get away from that and more towards calling it 22q 11.2 deletion. But in fairness, for all the old names, it's just they didn't discover the genetic cause of it till the early 90s. And so it is the most common microdeletion in humans. It's about half as common as trisomy 21, but not nearly as well known. And it can cause congenital heart disease, often pretty significant congenital heart disease in about two-thirds of patients. That would be the big newborn pickup is heart murmur. One tricky thing is that kids with 22q 11.2 deletion are more likely to have an intact palate with palatal dysfunction than they are an overt cleft. But having an overt cleft increases your risk of 22q. You know, that's just how the Venn diagrams sort of line up.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So they can present kind of like the submucous cleft palate kids with a lot of nasal regurgitation and feeding issues. but an intact palate. And then they also have some classic facial features that are subtle, but if you've seen it a few times, you can pick up on, including hooded upper eyelids and a broad nasal bridge and a kind of a bulbous nasal tip and small external ears, a little bit smaller than what you might think is proportional, but it can be really hard to pick up on those facial features. So I think a head-to-toe exam and then having a really low threshold for if you're picking up on two or more congenital anomalies, you know, you have clefting. I'm not saying that cleft lip and cleft palate equals two, but like clefting in general would be one, congenital heart disease two. That, in my opinion, is enough to refer to a geneticist. And a lot of craniofacial centers do have geneticists as part of their team, which can often lead to more prompt genetic testing that can actually help with the management rather than the long wait that like a separate referral could trigger, you know.
Say I'm the pediatrician in the newborn nursery, and maybe it wasn't known that the baby might have cleft lip or cleft palate by ultrasound, and you're assessing it for the first time. What types of testing would I consider during that period? Is that something that I need to worry about? Are there scenarios where, oh, it's just a single cleft lip, I don't have to worry about it, I'm not going to do any testing? Can you describe that maybe a little bit for some of our general audience?
Yeah, you know, and I want to acknowledge that this might shift over time, and this is the approach that we've discussed as our and within our craniofacial center. But generally, if we are seeing a patient for the first time in clinic or maybe in the newborn nursery, and they have cleft lip and palate, and they're feeding really well with they're using a cleft specific bottle, which I'm sure we'll touch on later, and they're gaining weight well, and developmentally they are thriving. And you feel like you do your head-to-toe exam, and your gut as a newborn nursery physician or a primary care provider is like, this is a healthy baby who doesn't, I'm not picking up on tone issues. I'm not picking up on a heart murmur. There's nothing different about their hands and feet. Their facial features look typical to me aside from the cleft lip. Then I often recommend against genetic testing, but always offer genetic counseling to every family. And sometimes in the very beginning, families are like, whoa, we have a lot on our plate right now with feeding issues and getting used to having a newborn at home. And so a lot of times families don't jump on that, but it's a really wonderful opportunity for like family planning, because having a baby with clefting increases their risk if they choose to have another child of partners having another child with clefting, and our genetic counselors can break it down. But I don't tend to dive into genetic testing if they have what seems to be isolated cleft lip and palate.
Now, I do want to get back into some of that guidance you're giving parents. Before we get there, are there any other labs I may consider in a newborn period? Like, would I get chemistries, checking at calcium? Would I do that for most of them, or only for the ones I'm really, really concerned with, with like maybe two different abnormalities that I'm seeing?
Yeah, so I think you should have bring up a really good point regarding 22q, is that there's a increased risk of neonatal hypocalcemia. 22q can cause many, many different issues beyond just the congenital heart disease. And so I would say that if your gut is that there's something more than just isolated cleft palate, then that's a very good idea to check chemistries. And I think that also there's another thing in the newborn period, especially with isolated, what initially presents as isolated cleft palate, another entity that I think is really important for newborn nursery physicians and primary care physicians to know about is Roban sequence, which is not a syndrome in and of itself, but is about 50% of the time syndrome is identifiable. And Roban sequence is, there's a lot of theories about what causes it, but it's one thought is that it is a sequence of events that occurs in utero where for some reason the mandible is undersized, and that leads to the tongue being positioned more posteriorly and flipping back, which is called glossoptosis. And that glossoptosis in utero, it causes the tongue to be in the way, preventing the palate from fully forming. And so the cleft, if it's an isolated cleft palate, it tends to be a V-shaped cleft, whereas if it's Roban sequence, you might be kind of like wondering, does this baby have a smaller lower jaw? And they may have a more U-shaped cleft of the palate. And sometimes you can literally witness when the baby is supine, which of course normally we would want babies to be sleeping on their back, and the baby will make some pretty dramatic noises like that sound like snoring, and you can watch the tongue fall into and maybe even behind the cleft, and that noise is kind of like kind of a choking and snoring noise called stertor, which I quite quickly in my craniofacial career learned about, and am embarrassed to say I didn't know about really in my primary care days, and quite different from stridor, that more high-pitched laryngomalacia noise. I know that that's not just from laryngomalacia, but so Roban sequence, these infants can present with quite significant feeding difficulties because they're having a, on top of having a cleft palate, they're trying to coordinate suck, swallow, breathe, suck, swallow, breathe, but they can't, they're like, I can't really worry about the suck and the swallow. I just need to focus on breathing. It's really hard to breathe. And so they're burning extra calories with every breath. We keep telling them to sleep on their back and they keep having those noises. They might start having intermittent DSATs. Sometimes they get sent home, right? Because it's like maybe they're okay at first and then they start to tire out day 4, 5, or 6 and you see them in the office. And so that can be tricky. So if you see a baby with cleft palate and you're wondering about their jaw, that's definitely something to be keeping in mind is Roban sequence.
So it sounds like from a summary perspective that when you see cleft lip, you're looking for other congenital anomalies with which to then go down that road, but otherwise it doesn't necessarily need to be the case. So for example, if you have a cardiac defect, if you have abnormal face, you know, you're thinking 22q11, and then we think about sending, you know, calcium tests at that time, but it's not necessarily the most common. Same thing when it comes to, you know, Roban sequence where, you know, the jaw looks extra small. So you're noticing something else to say, hey, this is now going to be part of a syndrome. But ultimately, a lot of these patients, it sounds like it doesn't. And as you said, you wouldn't even send genetic testing for those things. Does that sound correct just as a summary? Because then I'm going to jump back to clinic.
Yeah. The only other thing I'd add is like, I think that there might be some, you know, very, especially as genetic testing advances so much for isolated cleft palate, where half of them have a syndrome, I think there's different thresholds for every craniofacial center, every clinician, every parent or guardian, you know, so that I have a lower threshold. If they have isolated cleft palate, I'm not going to like wrestle the family into the geneticist's office, but it lowers my threshold a little bit.
Gotcha. And the nice thing it sounds like when you get referred to you is that, hey, maybe they might come in the door and sit with you anyways. So you might get closer from that piece. So just coming back to clinic, you know, let's kind of say that just because oral faces visit with you is actually in 2 days from now. So the pediatrician sees them like, all right, you know what? You're just going to see the specialist in 2 days. When you see them for that first visit, what are the things that you're going to talk about? What's the anticipatory guidance? What are the concerns that these parents are going to have? And what do you sit down and talk about in that first visit?
Some parents, their first, second, and third concern is about feeding. And that's usually our first concern too, so that we really dovetail well. And so we emphasize how normal it is for there to be feeding challenges and that it's no one's fault because it's just like the poor little one can't generate that suction. And especially like in the scenario with oral face where it sounds like they were diagnosed postnatally and they're still attempting to breastfeed, I think that they may not have the appropriate cleft bottle. So that's one thing that we focus a lot on is normalizing that it's really difficult for a baby to be able to feed without a one-way valve. And so there's a one-way valve that, so the most common brand in the U.S. is the Dr. Brown's Zero Resistance Specialty Feeding System. We usually just call it the special Dr. Brown's bottle with that blue disc, you know, when we're in clinic. And the annoying thing is that Dr. Brown's only sells that blue disc as part of an expensive big kit to families. Craniofacial centers can get the individual discs and then we just hand them out to families whenever they're in clinic. So they have some, because you can just put that blue disc in underneath the nipple in any Dr. Brown's bottle and it will work. And it just means that when the baby compresses the nipple, milk will come out, but won't be able to go backwards into the bottle. And then when the nipple reinflates, more milk is brought in. So that one-way valve allows for many, not all, but many babies with clefting to feed better. There's another brand called Pigeon. It's just not as widely available in the U.S., but is similarly effective. And then for those of us that are older that are listening, there's the what we used to call the Haberman bottle, which is now owned by Medela. So it's called the Medela Specialty Feeding System and Special Needs Feeder, that is, Medela Special Needs Feeder. And there's a little more work for the feeder, for the caregiver, where the caregiver is supposed to compress the nipple in time with when the baby's feeding. And that's not my favorite choice for a sleep-deprived caregiver. It's more stressful and less bonding. They're more worried about doing it right than just being with their baby. And so we tend to favor the Dr. Browns. But there are times where the Medela is better. It has a longer nipple, which can be really helpful for babies with Roban sequence, where showing some safety to be able to try oral feeding. And then is it okay to also touch on other non-bottle changes for
touch on everything. Definitely.
That's it all. Oroface also has a cleft of the lip. And so, especially if a baby has a complete cleft of the lip where there is no tissue completing the nostril, the cleft can be quite wide, and then that can make it more difficult to create a seal around the nipple of the bottle. And so a lot of times the nurses in the craniofacial center and or the feeding specialists can help to coach families on how to perhaps move the nipple a little bit over to the non-cleft side in a unilateral cleft situation so that they can use their gum line to compress that nipple. And then lip tape is something that can be done at home. Craniofacial teams can teach caregivers how to put, it's similar to Steri-Strips, but there's just a little bit of elastic in the middle, and it goes across the upper lip and closes the gap. And then that has multiple benefits. It can help with feeding right away because it can broaden how much you can compress the nipple with. And then it also kind of trains the premaxilla. So like in the scenario of unilateral cleft, like oroface, the premaxilla, or that central part of the upper gum line where the front teeth will eventually come, your central incisors will eventually come in, it can deviate kind of anteriorly and kind of come out underneath the nose. In the case of bilateral cleft, it can kind of do whatever it wants, and it usually wants to come anteriorly and kind of press the philtrum up to the underside of the nose, and it can go off to the left or the right. And so the lip tape can kind of say, hey, premaxilla, why don't you come back here into the mouth and into a more neutral position? And then it can prepare for surgery by bringing the edges of the cleft, the skin edges, closer together. So sometimes there are cases where the premaxilla is so out of position that lip tape alone is not enough. And then nasoalveolar molding can be considered, which a craniofacial orthodontist can design for a family. We could go into that. I don't know how much time we have, but that is another option.
Yeah, it sounds like in general that if you have a palate, certainly you're going to need the one-way valve. If you have a lip, it sounds like you're going to need something to at least bring the skin closer together, and that's the tape. And then it sounds like also, we don't have to go into how orthodontists make this, but it sounds like if the gap is so large, there's a prosthetic of some variety that they can almost put in there to essentially close the gap so you can have the gums come down, or the gums, or at least the lips come down on this area for the baby to feed. Does that sound like an overall way to hit kind of all three of these steps, or am I missing a component of there?
Well, I think you just hit on a really important point that I left out in thinking of oroface, who has a cleft lip and palate. This baby deserves both the lip tape and the special bottle, but you make a really good point. Like if they only have cleft lip, a baby with isolated cleft lip, even if they have a cleft of the gum line, but you are pretty confident that they have an intact palate, they often can breastfeed and can use a regular bottle. So it's really the cleft palate that creates that difficulty with generating suction. Cleft lip can have caused some problems with latching for breastfeeding, but a lot of times they can latch even without lip tape, but especially when they get a little bit of support from a craniofacial nurse or a lactation consultant, they often can successfully breastfeed. That being said, understandably, a lot of lactation consultants and feeding therapists and medical providers outside of craniofacial centers don't know about the connection with cleft palate and an inability to breastfeed or use a typical bottle. And so a lot of times these kids can come into the office pretty underweight.
And what's the incidence of, it sounds like we have great tools for this. So like most of these kids are going to end up being able to feed by mouth. How many of these kids end up with NG tube, or is it very, very small group?
Good question. Before I answer, you just brought up, we do have great tools. Sadly, most community hospitals don't buy those tools. So the average community hospital, at least in Washington State, usually stocks a Mead Johnson squeeze bottle, which looks sort of like an Elmer's glue bottle. And it is the least effective cleft bottle. So it's in that scenario, it has a fairly routine, normal nipple, and you just have to squeeze it. And that's it. And it's not great. We don't recommend it. And so if we are lucky enough to have a prenatal visit, we often recommend that families, and we send families, in fact, a sample box of the Dr. Brown's specialty feeding system so that they can bring that in their go bag to the hospital.
Oh, it was about NG tubes. I was curious about,
Yeah, it's definitely a minority. It's not an insignificant minority, but it is definitely the exception, not the rule that that babies with cleft lip and palate would need an NG. That being said, we do have a significant subset that do. I would guesstimate maybe like 10 to 15%.
For those mothers who really want to do breastfeeding, and it sounds like if they have good support with knowledgeable consultants, they can. Are there other types of devices that could assist with breastfeeding, just like you do with bottle feeding, or is it mostly just a lot of technique in trying to hold and support?
It's really more, unfortunately, it's focused on like comfort. So a lot of times, comfort and bonding. So a lot of times we counsel mothers who are really motivated to breastfeed to breastfeed and then to pump. It kind of depends on the infant. So if an infant gets really revved up and frustrated, then sometimes it goes better to bottle feed first and then finish with some breastfeeding at the end so that they are content and can focus on bonding. And then there may be some benefit to breast milk supply for doing this as well, in addition to mother-child bonding. But it, unfortunately, I don't know of any tools that can lead to successful like weight gain with breastfeeding. And so it's really hard at that, especially at that first visit. It's something that you have to acknowledge and support them through.
And so kind of going back to that first visit, we kind of mentioned feed. I feel like we had a good conversation about that. Is there any other, you know, things that we need to be paying attention to, other pieces of anticipatory guidance that you kind of give these families?
I think that another aspect that would be difficult to expect a primary care provider to be able to rattle the whole thing off, but a lot of families are like very focused on the surgical plan. Like, when are we getting going on all of this? And so sometimes at the prenatal visit, or the first visit, that's like the only thing that they want to talk about, or the first thing they want to talk about, and so that varies. I think that one thing that makes it hard to counsel everyone who might listen to this podcast on is that it's going to vary from center to center a little bit. So I would say that the range to share with families for cleft lip repair is typically 3 to 6 months of age. Thinking of a full term infant, we often do use corrected ages if it's a baby who was born earlier, and that can lead to some challenges with if they are one of those patients who's struggling a little bit more with feeding and are maybe in that 10 to 15% that might need it, you know, an admission for NG teaching. Unfortunately, it puts this time crunch in the family's mind, because there may be some differences from plastic surgeon to plastic surgeon, but most do not want an NG tube to be present when they do the lip repair, because it's not just a lip surgery, it's a nasal surgery as well, very much so. And so if a NG is in place, even on the non-cleft side, in the case of a unilateral cleft, the NG could have really negative consequences on the way that heals. And so at least at our institution, the surgeons are pretty adamant that there not be an NG in place. And the last thing you really want to do if a baby has dysphagia is start forcing them to eat more by mouth if they're giving you clear signs that they're not ready. And so sometimes that means we do have some patients who end up, unfortunately, have to get a G-tube prior to the lip repair. For that reason, I really favor our approach of waiting till 6 months of age because it gives families more time. And a lot of, I would say probably the majority of the kids who briefly need an NG are able to come off of it with good support from feeding therapists and nutritionists and pediatricians and nurses and everyone.
Are there any other indications for delayed repair outside of, you mentioned having an NG present, waiting till they're nice and feeding and growing well? Are there other things that that a surgeon may have to think about for delayed repair? And actually, are there reasons for maybe accelerated early repair?
I can't think of any reasons for accelerated early repair. There are downsides that our plastic surgeons cite for waiting too long on repair, like past 8 to 9 months full term or corrected age. But their main focus is on wound healing. And so if a baby is underweight, their biggest concern really links back to those kids who are having trouble feeding, is that if a baby is having trouble feeding by mouth and is underweight due to that, the surgeon will often want to wait on the lip repair or the palate repair because they're worried that there's an increased risk of infection, increased risk of difficulty with wound healing, and the outcome of the surgery will be poorer. I think another less common scenario would be, like, for instance, a baby who has an overt cleft lip with 22q deletion syndrome or another syndrome. The lip repair would be taking a backseat to, for instance, like congenital heart surgery that's needed. So we often are partnering with specialists outside of the craniofacial center to say, okay, is this patient safe for this surgery? Especially checking in with the cardiologist, but sometimes other specialists as well.
And then, so that was kind of the cleft lip, but I assume that was actually just like isolated cleft lip repair. How is cleft palate different than that?
Yeah, so cleft palate repair is later, and the biggest reason for this is that the palate, when it is repaired and the swelling, the post-op swelling occurs, it's part of the upper airway, and we can see upper airway obstruction if a palate is repaired too young. Also, if the palate is repaired too young, which say maybe under, the general accepted range most centers agree on is 9 to 15 months of age. So in cases where it's repaired earlier than that, there's some evidence that maxillary retrusion or having your midface set too far back at skeletal maturity and having an underbite, you're at an increased risk. Now, that you, if you have cleft palate, you are at an increased risk for that period, but you're definitely at an increased risk for that if your palate is repaired too soon. But the number one short-term worry is that we could get those kids into temporary trouble with breathing. For that reason, we tend to wait at our center. We are a pretty conservative center, so I would say that we like to wait till 6 months on lip repair, and we like to wait till 12 to 15 months for palate repair. And in babies with Roban sequence who are improving and doing better, we often want a sleep study that shows that their sleep apnea is minimal, and often it's more like 15 to 18 months for the repair.
And you're talking about literally just waiting for the kid to get bigger so their airway's bigger, right? That's what we're talking about for older. And then the other thing that I was going to say is, now these kids at 12 months, 15 months, they're eating table foods. We talked about all this reflux and stuff like that that exists, with milk coming up the nose and stuff like that. Do these kids get symptomatic, with regular foods coming up and out of their nose as they get older this way?
That's a really good question. They tend to do really well with purees. So if we imagine that Oroface, this baby is doing really well with bottle feeds, no major issues with feeding, and then the parents want to introduce baby food at 6 months. I don't want to get too controversial. I don't know. I was always open to 4 to 6 months when I was in primary care, but so let's say it's 6 months and their first food is not too acidic, like pureed avocado or something, and they love it. They might have a little green dribble out their nose. And so it's not just during the process of regurgitation, but also just during feeding, sometimes a little bit of milk can escape out the nose or a little bit of that baby food. And for most babies, it really doesn't bother them. I have had a few parents share with me that, you know, it was the first time that they tried like an orange slice with maybe like a 10-month-old, and then the baby got upset, and perhaps the acidity of that citrus or maybe like a red sauce, like a tomato sauce, was bothering them. So there's like just a little bit. I tend to caution families on that, but temper that with like, hey, if they're enjoying it, it's safe. It's not going to hurt them that a little bit of it is escaping out their nose. One thing that's really hard is that developmentally, they are getting bored of purees, you know, at like 8 to 10 months. And they're like, I want what you're eating. And then we go and repair their palate. And then our surgeons, who, you know, they don't know anything about development, right? And they're like, nope, nothing but soft stuff for the next 2 weeks. It's at a very tough time. So I think it's really important to not undersell how challenging the recovery from palate repair is, especially the cleft lip repair. The pain is milder. And most kids, we encourage feeding like in the PACU, like right after, like they can feed, and they often go home the next day. And it's very rare that they have to be readmitted. But palate repair is another challenge where the pain is deeper in the throat. With every swallow, there's pain. And you also have taken away their favorite foods for 2 weeks. And so that, I think it's there's been times where I felt like I didn't provide enough warning to families, and yeah, I hope I've improved on that, you know.
Are there other things that we need to be cognizant of as like the general pediatrician during this time period before surgical repair or even immediately afterwards that we need to think about? I know a lot of these children in general are sort of at higher risk for things like eustachian tube dysfunction. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So eustachian tube dysfunction, kids with, if you have a cleft palate, you almost certainly have eustachian tube dysfunction, but usually they pass their newborn hearing screen. And then at least at our craniofacial center, we routinely check their hearing at the 9-month team visit, and they almost always have conductive hearing loss by that time. And so sometimes I worry that we're not treating their conductive hearing loss during infancy enough, and that often comes down to a challenge of like access in audiology and insurance coverage of bone conduction sound processors and things like that. But it is very treatable at the time of palate repair with ear tubes. So the vast majority, I think all of my patients since I joined the Craniofacial Center except one, had conductive hearing loss at the 9-month, 8 to 10-month-ish team visit and got ear tubes. And that has been shown in studies to improve speech outcomes for these kids. And so we almost always do the tubes at that time. Unfortunately, ear tubes placed prior to palate repair don't function very well. They tend not to help with hearing loss and tend to chronically drain mucus and stuff. So it can be a pretty unpleasant and ineffective endeavor. So we tend not to do ear tubes prior to palate repair.
That was a good question, Chris. Are there any other complications that we should know about other than eustachian tube dysfunction?
Yeah. Well, one other thing on that is that the rate of ear infections is a little bit higher, but not drastically higher than the general population. And it tends to follow the same pattern where, you know, it wasn't too often in my primary care days that I diagnosed a 0 to 6-month-old with a definite otitis media. More in the latter half of infancy and then toddlerhood is where I tended to see more ear infections. And that trend seems to hold true in my patients with cleft palate, but a little bit higher rate, not dramatically higher, but a little bit higher rate. Another thing that we can see in infancy is some dental differences. And sometimes they can be presenting prior to the age at which you would normally establish primary dental care. So it could fall to the primary care physician to provide some assessment and reassurance. And so one thing that can be found is a natal tooth. Sometimes a baby can be born with a tooth usually near or within the site of the alveolar cleft. So this is in a baby who does have a cleft of the gum line. And that tooth sometimes can be quite loose. And our worry is that it could get aspirated. And so we tend to get those kids in as quick as possible and have one of our plastic or oral surgeons just pluck it out. It's usually in pretty much a non-event in clinics, not too difficult, but I don't tend to do it. I think there are pediatricians who probably would and feel quite confident doing that, but we tend to have our surgeons take a look at it, remove it. And then sometimes the primary teeth can come in, there can be extra teeth, so supernumerary teeth. There can be teeth that come in kind of diagonal within the area of the cleft. Maybe they're coming in at the more typical time, but kind of coming in that cleft area diagonally. Our dental team tends to be pretty hands-off regarding the primary teeth, unless the tooth is coming in a really unusual fashion that's maybe scraping on the inside of the lip and causing the baby discomfort. So in my time, in my 5 years on the team, I don't think I've ever had a baby with clefting need to have primary teeth addressed with removal. We definitely don't recommend orthodontia of primary teeth. And so we're pretty hands-off on the primary teeth, but then later start to focus a lot on the dentition with the secondary teeth coming in. Other complication, I don't know, not a complication, but I think an association that because of what we touched on earlier with the possibility of syndromes, where we tend to be in the craniofacial center. For those craniofacial centers that have pediatricians like in Seattle, we tend to be kind of doubling up with the primary care doc a bit on developmental monitoring. But I think developmental monitoring is really important because we would not expect a patient with isolated cleft lip and palate or isolated cleft palate to have developmental delay without a clear explanation. Maybe they have some speech delay that maybe you could explain with the cleft palate, and I'm sure we'll touch on that. But if they have like global developmental delay in the setting of clefting, I would be pretty concerned that there's something more going on.
Going back a little bit about the dental team, as you're talking about, as a patient progresses, now would this be a special dental team that's usually associated with a, you know, craniofacial clinic, or will most like pediatric dentists at least have some reasonable knowledge about taking care of children, especially as they hit school age or older, in terms of managing their tooth health and potential issues they might come across?
Yeah, I think most primary dentists in the community will be very comfortable managing patients with clefting. They can definitely do all of the primary dental care, cleaning, fluoride, preventative care. Where they may have less comfort is with the orthodontic plan, but they can collaborate with. So there is definitely a dentist and or orthodontist as part of just about every craniofacial team. But they usually, we're dealing with like a 5-state region. So we might have a patient in Montana, comes to Seattle once a year. We are collaborating with the local dentist and we also want to find a local orthodontist to pursue the plan that our orthodontist develops and collaborates with them on. So.
Awesome. So let's go back to oral face, you know, kind of we're walking our way through the surgery as a primary care doctor. We're kind of paying attention for a couple things, you know, we're watching to see if you use station tube dysfunction, you know, sometimes there might be some conductive hearing loss. So we're paying attention a little bit to speech delay, but we know she's going to get surgery. So she would say it, you know, somewhere around, she's having surgery in Seattle or Cashlack Northwest, excuse me. So she's going to be having, you know, at 6 months, she has her lip repaired, and then we'll say at around 12 months or so, she has her palate repaired with her eustachian tubes placed. She's recovered okay. What are the complications that we should start to look for now as we're past our repair? You know, what are those complications that we should look for as pediatricians for patients who have already had surgery?
I think we touched a bit on like the challenges, which are temporary, of feeding. Usually within a few weeks, the surgeon has cleared them to go back to oral feeding and they're loving that they're back to their normal diet. I think that the top focus after palate repair is on speech. And so it's more the norm than the exception that we would want these infants and then toddlers to be connected with their local early intervention center. We tend to nickname it Birth to Three out in Washington, but I know it probably has different names everywhere within the country. And so we really love to have our kids connected with a early intervention speech therapist. And then we also want our craniofacial speech pathologist to assess the patient, because what can be very hard to discern is what is a developmental speech difference that has nothing at all to do with the clefting. And might even be adorable, like some challenges with R's or something. And what is and can be treated completely with just speech therapy. What is velopharyngeal mislearning? Velopharyngeal meaning palate to the back of the throat. Sometimes a baby who or toddler who just had their palate repaired now has, they've already have been watching their caregivers talk and like, ooh, okay, I'm going to try to mimic that noise, but I can't yet. I can't make a hard. So you need to be able to touch the back of your throat with your soft palate to make a hard consonant sound. And if they're trying to say a hard consonant sound prior to their palate repair, they might learn that they can't do that. And then they might try something else instead, like a glottic stop where they kind of go using their voice box to mimic that noise. Then they have to unlearn that habit and learn how to use their palate. And so an umbrella term for that is velopharyngeal mislearning, which also is treatable with therapy. And a lot of times the craniofacial speech pathologist can collaborate with the local speech therapist. But then there's also perhaps 10 to 20% of kids could have VPI, velopharyngeal insufficiency, where the properly repaired, the surgeon did the palate repair correctly, but the palate just cannot reach the back of the throat all the way. And then no matter how much therapy they go through, they will still have difficulty with those hard consonants. And there are surgeries that can be done. There can be a lot of regional differences and different opinions from different surgeons on what the best surgical approach is. And sometimes there even can be a speech pathologist with an ear, nose, and throat surgeon scoping the child at like maybe 3 to 5 years old to see how close are we to closure, where is the lack of movement, or where does it come up short, and come up with a surgical plan, prove that surgery is needed as well. But that's a procedure that not every three-year-old votes yes for, you know, so that's a definite challenge.
All right. So you just kind of talked us through the speech pieces that we should be paying attention to. Speech pathologist, that was monitoring for a while, getting an EI, I'm sure gets into school speech as they get older. You also mentioned a fair amount about orthodontia and dental early on. Would you mind just completing that thought about what the complex from the dentist perspective are?
Yeah. So from a dental perspective, if like in the case of oral face, there's a cleft of the gum line, the third definite surgery in that case of a patient with cleft lip and palate is that they will also need what's called an alveolar bone graft, where the plastic surgeon or oral surgeon takes a small amount of bone marrow from their hip and opens up the gum line and puts that bone marrow to complete the gum line. And that is typically done somewhere between 7 and 10 years old. It depends on how quickly that patient's secondary teeth are maturing in, because they want to put that bone graft in there in time for there to be an anchor for the permanent teeth. And the alveolar bone graft is the most challenging surgery in terms of success rate, and the highest risk factor for failure is definitely poor dental health leading into the surgery. So that's where that primary dental routine care, minimizing caries and, you know, that cariogenic bacterial flora can be so helpful. And then later on, there's a significant minority of kids who have a history of cleft palate who, as I touched on earlier, develop an underbite where their upper jaw is set behind their lower jaw, class 3 malocclusion. And then it's ideal, unless they have severe sleep apnea that presses us to do something earlier, that we wait till skeletal maturity to do jaw surgery. And there's usually orthodontic care before and after that jaw surgery. And then some patients might also choose to do a lip and nose revision, especially kids with a history of unilateral cleft where they may have nasal asymmetry. And it's a case by case, whether that's before or after the jaw surgery. And then some teens with a history of Roban sequence might have the opposite, where they have an overbite, where they still have a bit of a small mandible and they might also benefit from jaw surgery.
This is a great conversation to have, because I assumed that you have your kind of repairs at, you know, 3 to 6 months and 9 to 15 months, and you are good to go, right? Everything is back. But it sounds like we keep adding on more surgeries. When is the surgical care considered complete, or is it a case-by-case basis?
I think it's a case-by-case basis. If we have a teen where the plastic surgeon says, boy, you have a underbite and your nasal asymmetry, and the teen's like, leave me alone, we leave them alone. You know, the teen's in charge. On the other hand, our surgeons are willing to do the surgery at any age. I think this probably is not super unique, but they have privileges at an adult hospital as well. So we really want to complete their craniofacial surgical care as part of our center. But at the same time, maybe focus on transition. If they are a medically complex patient, like who's in our 22Q clinic, then we very much need to transition. We need to focus on the transition of their other things, their other specialties. But we want to complete their surgeries within our center.
That actually goes to my next question. You know, as a med peds doc, transitions are always very important to me. Can you sort of describe a little bit what transition looks like for our adolescent patients as they go into adulthood?
I mean, it's something that we're trying to improve right now. We're developing a transition craniofacial transition program that I think the main focus, if it's a patient who had isolated cleft lip and palate, no syndrome is suspected, we really want to focus on transitioning them to an adult, a primary care provider who sees adults, and give them a nice, clean, portable medical summary that they can share with that primary care provider, and then also just be part of the support in connecting them to any specialists they might need. But we really want to have them feel like their craniofacial care is complete. I think that it's very, very different, and this is what makes it challenging to develop a program for all of these patients, is that it's a very different picture for a patient with an underlying syndrome, in which case we are trying to transition them to specialists who are comfortable with that syndrome, still completing any craniofacial surgeries that they need. I think that the surgical point, we want to complete it. The medical part, we need to do better at transitioning all of the things, and then having them have something, whether it's an old school paper copy or something a little bit more advanced or both, that they can point to and say, this is all the stuff that I had care for when I was a kid for my craniofacial needs.
Should we move on?
Yeah, let's move on. So we kind of talk about this a fair amount in our show. We usually don't like to do this at the end, and so I apologize to our listeners for that. But one of the questions that we like to just focus on are some of the disparities that we see in medicine and what we can at least do to address those. So for in this case, you know, what racial or socioeconomic disparities are we seeing in the treatment of this type of craniofacial anomaly?
Yeah, in the case of cleft lip and palate, there have been some pretty recent studies showing that the lip repair and the palate repair tend to occur later in patients that are not white, and with that being a strongest trend in Asian patients. I don't know why that is, but that is definitely a disparity that is seen. And then I also see in my practice day to day, I think that there's, I think we need to do better in terms of developing trust and a collaborative approach when it comes to feeding issues with underrepresented minorities. I think that's a major challenge for craniofacial centers, and to do better and to fully explain, especially patients where English is not their preferred language. I think we do an inadequate job sometimes of fully explaining why breastfeeding is not possible, for example, or why we can't have an NG at the time of the lip repair or the palate repair. And so, you know, and we give the same amount of time for each slot, regardless of how many words need to be spoken, right? And so I think that is something that is challenging. This could be somewhat unique to the Northwest because we're covering a 5-state region, but I bet it's an issue elsewhere too, is that there's major geographic disparities that I think often dovetail with the socioeconomic disparities, where we see a lot of patients who had an initial surgical attempt done by a plastic surgeon who's not a part of a craniofacial, an accredited ACPA accredited craniofacial center. And those lip and especially palate repairs tend to go poorly. And if you are trying to repair something that scarred and then reopened, it gets less and less effective each time, no matter how talented and experienced the surgeon. So I think that that's a major issue, is a family knowing that there might be a better choice, and a primary care provider knowing in a more remote part of the country that maybe they should refer somewhere a little further and less convenient for the family. That's a challenge. I also think that there's challenges related to the geographic demands with access to certain treatments, such as nasoalveolar molding that we touched on, where it's real finicky and you have to go in every 1 to 3 weeks. You know, a family in Seattle is a lot more likely to be able to undertake that than a family in Eastern Washington, you know. We also know that patients of the First Nations have higher rates of early childhood caries, and we touched on how having dental issues can lead to poor outcomes within the clefting treatment. And then also there's major issues for families when it comes to orthodontic coverage with their insurances. Like, there's a lot that we can convince is medically necessary, but the insurances still try to fight back on some of it being more aesthetic, and so that can be a problem for some of our families as well.
And this is really important just to recognize, you know, not that we all have all the answers to the healthcare system for some of these things, but we can recognize our biases that when we walk into these rooms, we say, hey, we know that often people with, you know, feeding issues, we don't give the appropriate time, we don't give the appropriate explanations, we don't use appropriate language interpreters, you know, all those things we can know, you know, having talked to you today, we can walk into those appointments knowing our own biases and do a little bit better that time. You know, to fix the insurance companies and things, we know that this on this podcast, you know, are we making the biggest difference? I don't know. But at least at the end of the day, we can all talk about it. We all know what the issues are. So when we walk into those patients' rooms, we can recognize right off the bat, this is going to be an issue and we should recognize this and do something about it before it gets out of hand. That's the biggest goal for kind of talking. So thank you for sharing those pieces.
Yeah, thank you.
I think we should wrap it up. Don't you think, Sam?
Oh, yeah. Let's do it.
All right, Matt, we're going to ask you, what are your take-home points for our listeners?
Well, one is related to my favorite failure is that I knew very little about any of the things I just said for 11 years in primary care. And I was a resident at Seattle Children's where I did learn a little bit about craniofacial stuff, but I still, you know, so like it clefting is considered common, but at 1 to 600 or 1 to 700 for cleft lip and palate, you might have 2 or 3 patients in a panel of 2000. And so it's pretty hard to get super confident. So I think just going easy on yourself, but and kind of thinking of yourself, your role as a primary care provider is monitoring this child's growth and development and maybe being an advocate for them with the craniofacial center, acknowledging that I know your time is extremely limited. I think, yeah, just that you don't have to know everything about clefting to be a huge help for that family. Just kind of alerting, like, hey, this family's really worried about their palate repair. And I think also just noting that feeding is a gigantic stressor early in life and that family. And I think sometimes, especially in the craniofacial centers, we can say, oh, you just have, you know, we don't say that, but like, I think we can kind of forget that this is like a very traumatic thing for a baby to have a birth difference and that the family is going to need a lot of psychosocial support as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. We really, really appreciate you spending tonight with us. It was a wonderful discussion. I definitely learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners did as well. Before we go, is there anything you'd like to plug? Any websites, any societies, anything that you want our listeners to check out before we go?
Yeah, so I'd like to plug acpacares.org, which is the ACPA website, the American Cleft Palate Craniofacial Association, and right there on their homepage is find an ACPA approved team, because you really want your patients deserve that multidisciplinary approach and the very experienced surgeons performing those procedures.
That's a great plug. I think that'll help a lot of people, actually. So, yeah, fantastic.
And we'll put it on our show notes, and we'll have it all here for everybody to take a listen. So thank you so much, Matt, for coming on, sharing expertise, and also as your background as a primary care doctor, I think is huge for all of us here. So thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids.
Get show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We are committed to providing you with high-value practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producer for this episode, Emily Wells, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter and Instagram. So I've been Sam Mazur.
This has been Chris the Chimanchu. Thank you. Good night. And for those who have made it all the way to the end, you're going to have a wonderful gift of another poem written by AI. The title is The First Smile. In the soft light of the newborn ward, a small discovery, a cleft revealed in the tender sweep of a newborn smile. With the gentle hands and words soft as the morning, I speak of pathways, of surgeries like small miracles, fashioning wholeness where once the delicate divide. We map the journey together, nutrition, speech, the embrace of a team woven through the child's first cries, first words, first smiles unbroken. Each visit, a step, each treatment, a stitch in the fabric of a life we mend together. See you guys.